to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and it is the 15th of October 2012. I can hardly believe it. I'm amazed at how fast this year has gone. And this is episode 140, and you can get all the backlist of the podcast on at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. So today I have a really great interview for you with Polly Courtney, who is another Brit, and she is famous for ditching her publishers over the chick lit covers they put on her books, which she believed was false marketing. So it's a really interesting tale of, and also how she got started. And she's also a PR expert. So I ask her a lot about how she uses traditional media, which is just something I just don't know much about, really. I've tried it and I kind of gave up. So really good to talk to her about how to use traditional media, newspapers and TV and that type of thing. But first of all, some updates. I am working on Exodus. I'm working on another edit. I'm really enjoying the book, actually. This is where it's another arc in my Arcane series, and it's the hunt for the Ark of the Covenant as the Middle East counts down to a religious war. It's so much fun. I'm really enjoying it. But basically, my agent had said, you know, she wanted to keep a novel that hasn't been published for if anybody buys the other books. And I'm really not good at waiting. This whole kind of agent traditional publishing thing, it's all very well, but you know, basically I've said if nothing happens with any of the publishers, and the books have gone out to like 15 different publishers in New York, and if nothing happens, I'm publishing Exodus in December anyway. So I'm just getting on with it. I'm also planning to do a novella, an arcane novella, a little, you know, quick story before Christmas, maybe, you know, 20,000-30,000 words. So I've got a good idea for a little outing in Prague, which is should be quite fun. Which brings me on to the novella business model in general, something I will definitely be looking more into in 2013. If you got my newsletter, which if you've signed up for the Author 2.0 Blueprint on the site at thecreativepen.com/blueprint, the newsletter, I talked a bit about Hugh Howie, whose book Wool sold, you know, has sold, is still selling millions of copies, and he got signed up by Ridley Scott for movie rights, which is amazing. First self-published book, I think, to go that way, so very exciting. Anyway, his business model is write lots of novellas, see what catches on, and then expand the novellas in that series, and he's on, I think, number 9 of the Wool series. So fascinating idea. Basically, it's you know, you write a whole load of different things, but you don't invest 80,000 words, 100,000 words or whatever. You invest 20,000-30,000 words in more things and see what happens. So we can do that with ebooks. It's quite an exciting idea. So I'm really changing my mindset on shorter fiction at the moment. So that's one thing I'm doing. Another thing I am doing right now is I'm working very hard on a new multimedia course, which is called Turn Your Ideas into Cash. And it's actually a multimedia course on how to create multimedia products, because I've been asked so much for this. And I'm also partnering with a friend of mine who's a businesswoman, and we're doing it together to kind of expand the knowledge base and all the people we talk to, as well as the marketing. So if you're somebody who, probably mostly for non-fiction authors, if you want to take your book and turn it into a business, then you will find this really useful. You can get some free videos and a webinar if you sign up, and I've created a little tiny URL. So it's tinyurl.com/ideascash, IDEASCASH. So tinyurl.com/ideascash. And yeah, we're launching that in November. So you can sign up to get the free stuff, you know, no obligation to buy, of course. And you might be interested in that, because certainly that's enabled me to have a business while I'm building up the fiction side. I am planning to do NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month, in November, as if I haven't got enough on my plate. But I'm really keen to try and push myself with creating fiction at a more compressed time frame. I definitely am someone who spends a lot of time in research, and I want to try my hand at speeding up a bit. Saying that, I am in my spare time because I read a lot. So when I get off the computer, we don't have a TV, so I often read. That's what I tend to do. I read. So I'm reading books about the Resurrection Men, who in Britain, I don't know about America, but in Britain they used to dig up bodies for medical students to dissect back in the 17th, the 18th and 19th centuries. So really, really fascinating stuff. And I want to write a novel or a novella around it. But certainly I'm aiming for 50,000 words in November on that book, which is working title is Hunterian, and I have mentioned it before. I just still haven't written it. I've been thinking about it for 6 months, maybe. So anyway, I'm very keen on that. So that's my little update. And the other thing is, the podcast is now open to advertising. And today we have our first sponsor. So normally I would, you know, if people are interested, then an audio is brilliant. But also I will be talking about some of the books that get sponsored. You can find out more at thecreativepen.com/sponsor podcast. So here's the first book, and then we'll get into the interview with Polly Courtney on ditching publishers and PR. Our sponsor today is Dr. Margaret Seachest, book one of a trilogy of historical fiction novels set during India's struggle for freedom, the Azadi, from the Raj. The books weave a tale of international intrigue, conflict, and poignant love between interesting characters of that era. In 1965, an over 100-year-old sea chest of an American doctor, Margaret, is discovered in the storage room of a hospital in Delhi. Another American doctor, Sharif, who originally hails from Delhi and is on contract at the hospital, is entrusted with the task of locating the mysterious woman's relatives and returning her trunk. Margaret, born in New Jersey, achieves her heart's desire in 1850 to become one of the first North American women doctors. She marries her Canadian cousin, Robert, and travels with him to serve in the Crimean War of 1854. There they have to not only face hardships of battle, but also endure other conflicts. The surprise ending of Book One leaves Margaret in a quandary, whether to seek vengeance or to continue on with her journey to India. The novel, by Waheed Rabbani, explores Christian and missionary norms and Victorian values. The Underground Railroad and the Wars of 1812 and the Crimea are covered in a unique way. Dr. Margaret Seachest is available at Amazon, Apple iBookstore and other online stores. You can also visit the author's website at tiny.cc/W Rabbani. That's Rabbani. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Polly Courtney. Polly is the author of 6 novels, including It's a Man's World. She is also a media commentator, appearing on UK TV and in well-known magazines and newspapers. So welcome, Polly.
Hello, hi.
It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh no. So first up, why don't you tell us a bit more about you and your writing and publishing background?
Sure. Right, where do I start? I'll go right back to the beginning. I actually never intended to be a writer. Way back when I was little, I wasn't one of those people who had always wanted to write since age of 5. And I went into sciences and did an engineering degree and went into the city like a lot of engineers do. And I thought, this is going to be it. This is my career. I'm going to make lots of money and be a completely, you know, high flyer in the city, just like they told us we could be on the milk round. And I went into the city and quickly learnt that it actually wasn't all it was cracked up to be in any way, to the extent that I left and wrote a book about it. And that book went on to become my first novel, Golden Handcuffs. But I took an unusual route to publishing it. First, this was back in 2003 or four, and at that time, the route, the only route really, to publishing was to get yourself an agent and to get that agent to get you a traditional publisher. And so that's what I did, and I was in a good position where I had multiple options for an agent. I went along with one that I thought was the most commercial and sensible for me, and I watched as she touted it with the publishers. And the publishers started coming back with comments, and they were comments that all rang along the same lines, which was basically, we really like your style, and we think it's, you know, we like the way you write, but why on earth are you writing about the city? Who would want to know about that? And I got comments like, you know, can we cut all the office scenes? Or can we change the office scenes to scenes where she's splashing her money around that she's earned in the city? You know, buying handbags and lipstick and that. So I was literally, this was the sort of response I was getting. And I did take this on board and thought, well, do I want to write chick lit about buying handbags? And the answer was no. I really wanted to get this story out there. That was the whole point in my, you know, that was the story I wanted. So what I ended up doing was publishing it myself. And that was in 2006. And I just felt there was definitely a story there that needed telling. If the traditional publishers weren't willing to take it off, then I'd do it myself. And it turned out people did want to read about the city, and I sold the first print run, which was 10,000 copies within the first 3 months or so, and managed to get a whole load of press coverage. And to cut a long story short, I ended up going down the self-publishing route. And my success in self-publishing actually got me a deal with HarperCollins. So then I transitioned into traditional publishing.
Wow. And I mean, that's quite a story back then, you know, in the mid-2000s. You know, one day we'll look back and we're like, wow, the dark ages, no e-books, no...
Yeah, it really was like that. There were no e-books.
And you shifted print books. That's amazing. And then you got this traditional deal. But let's, you know, fast forward. So everyone was thinking, wow, the pinnacle of your success. And then I first heard of you last year when this girl gets on the TV and dumps her publisher because they're trying to put her in some chick lit box. And that was you. So tell us a bit more about that story.
Yes. And we always have to bear in mind that the press will say a story with a strapline, and there's always more to it underneath. So it's really nice to have the opportunity to tell you what lies underneath. What happened once I took on my publishing deal with HarperCollins was that I very quickly realised that I might have made a mistake in that this wasn't the right publishing deal for me, the right imprint of a publisher. And they were very... commercial is probably one way of describing them. And what they like to do, I discovered, was to package up books in the form of whatever the latest trend that was, you know, that was running through the publishing industry was. So my first book ended up being packaged in a way that was it was sort of straight for the Richard and Judy book list, which is great if my book had been, if the contents of the book had matched what was what it had ended up being packaged as. So with my first book, I thought, well, they're the experts, they know what they're doing, so absolutely I'll let this one, I'll let them go their way. And the second book came out around the time when X Factor was really quite big, and I wish I could show you a copy here, but look it up. The Fame Factor was what it ended up being called, not my choice. Yeah. I didn't have say over title or cover design, and that was really the point, I suppose. So The Fame Factor came out with all blue swirls and silver stars all over it, and I thought, wow, this is really not representative of what's inside, because ironically the story was about a young musician who signed with a big label and discovered that she didn't have so much say and that it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. So read in that what you will. But the publishers decided that X Factor was the way forward for that one, and I was really unconvinced. and thought about sort of walking out then, but then realised that I really did want to write this third book that I had in my mind, which was all about lads mags and the way they were influencing our society. So I wrote the third book about lads mags, and lo and behold, it came out looking like pure, pure chick lit, which I really didn't believe it was. And by this point, after three books, I just thought, I've really had enough. But rather bizarrely, there were conversations going on about, you know, when we're working together, and as though there was no problem. But for me, there was a bit of a problem. And I walked out on HarperCollins. And it may have seemed to people reading the press that I was throwing a hissy fit at something that was really not that important. But really what it represented was my fury, if you like, at the mismarketing, really, which is what it was. It was sort of packaging something as something that it wasn't. And just, I thought, sort of fooling the readers. You know, you're selling chalk as cheese, and so you're just disappointing everyone. That was really the main point. Although, of course, the press took up various different angles, and I suppose because they'd used the angle of sexism that I walked away from in the city, they continued that theme and talked about the kind of male-female thing and the my objection to the soft, fluffy, girly chick lit. Which is fine. It's sort of that was definitely one part of the issue. So yeah, that was the full story. But of course, the headlines sound better.
Yeah. No, that is fantastic, and it brings up a really good point, which is, you know, with self-publishing, you do, and we, you know, we call it kind of indie publishing now, independent. You make all the decisions and you act as a business person. Yeah. And from looking at you and your career now, I mean, you are a businesswoman. You went into business, and you now act as a businesswoman for your career. You're a speaker, you do media, you do all this stuff. So how do you feel now, and how does the issue of control come into your publishing decisions? Are you pure indie? Are you hybrid? What are you now?
It's a really good question, and you're totally right that I do see myself as more of a business person than anyone else, with a creative streak, obviously. But yeah, what I do is sort of control the process, and I suppose I do see myself as more of a director of the various elements of the publishing industry that I'm in, rather than actually the doer of. And there is a difference, because I think a lot of people think self-publishing is about doing it all yourself, but actually you should never design a cover if you're not a cover designer, and that etc. But yeah, so I do see myself there, and in terms of whether I'm pure self-publishing, I think I'm going that way, actually. I still do have books out, obviously, under the HarperCollins imprint.
Yeah.
And because they're actually still in print, their rights are with them, and so I can't do anything about the cover design at the moment, because they're all so recent. My plan is to buy back the rights when they go out of print. So, yeah, I think I'm definitely going down the pure self-publishing route, but I do acknowledge that actually at this point in time it's not right for everyone, and I'm certainly not advocating everybody just does it themselves.
No, fantastic. That's great. So let's talk about the media then, because, you know, you mentioned a few things there about the media skewing things, but I've seen you on, you know, morning TV, and you're in the papers and you're in magazines. So you've obviously got a kind of a really good relationship with media and PR and stuff. So first up, tell us a bit about, you know, how you personally deal with media.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't actually say I have that much of a relationship with them, but what I do is think about the media a lot and see how I can, you know, if I can participate in some way. So always at the back of my mind, whatever stage of a book whatever stage I'm at with a book, even if I'm only half, if it's only half written, if there's a theme in there that I think is being, you know, is being talked about in the media at this point, I'm quite happy to kind of go and offer to write a feature for a newspaper or a magazine, or get wheeled on to TV to talk about it. And it sounds a bit sort of arrogant to say I'm happy to go on TV and talk about it, but actually if you've got something to say and you genuinely have thought it through and you've researched the subject, then it's worth giving it a go. Authors have said to me, oh, as if I could ever go on TV or radio. But actually, I do believe if you've got something to say and it's intelligent and you've, you know, thought it through properly, there's no reason why not. And one of the things I always say is that with, particularly with newspapers and magazines, the features writers, they're often looking for things to feature. Whereas with book reviewers, they're kind of not looking for any books to review. They've got, you know, piles and piles of them and they don't even get to open half of them. With features writers and news and other parts of the newspaper and magazine, there's often spaces.
Okay, no, that's interesting because I know everyone's now kind of thinking, but how do I actually do that? You know, how do I get, you know, I've thought very intelligently about my stuff, but that doesn't mean I'm on like breakfast TV talking about it. So how have you managed to get those articles? And you've been in, you know, I remember reading Company magazine when I was whatever, and I saw you had an article in there. And so how do you actually get that media attention?
Sometimes it's a kind of cold contact situation where I will see that a writer has written about a subject before and they might be, you know, writing about something else and I will approach them. Or if there's a new story out, I will just go to a features writer. And I don't know them. I don't think I've really met any of the people who commissioned any of the work. And I'm by the way, I'm not a well-connected media person. I really, you know, people might think that, oh, you just must mix in those circles. Not really the case. But so sometimes it's a kind of cold contact. Other cases, it's a referral from someone that I've worked with in the past. And that's really important. So one of my pieces of advice would always be to follow up every lead. So even if it seems, you know, even if it's a hairdressing magazine that sort of you happen to meet someone in the pub who works for one and she says, oh, you know, I know a friend. Follow up that lead and see if the friend works somewhere else and whether she's, you know, looking for stories to write about, because something will always lead to something else.
Mm. And so that's kind of print, you know, print TV, radio. I mean, I originally, a few years back when I had a non-fiction book, I got on all of those and made it on national TV and was really excited, thought, yay, I'm going to sell millions of books. But actually, I saw no sales blip whatsoever from that. And therefore, I switched all my attention onto online marketing. So how do you feel about does traditional media sell books, especially if you're self-published and not in the bookstore?
Well, I would say it always comes down to what the book is and what the target readership is for that book. Mm. And the brilliant thing about new media, you know, online basically, is that you can be so much more targeted. So if you've written a book about growing courgettes, that won't appeal to the whole world, but there is a segment of society that's really interested in growing vegetables, so, you know, allotment owners and people on forums, and you can really target them. Mm. Whereas if you went on TV, it might be exciting to go on TV, but you probably wouldn't hit all those, you know, the actual number of people that you'd hit that would really want to read about growing vegetables might be quite small. So it's definitely worth thinking quite a lot about who you think your core market is. And that's a really hard thing to do if you just write general fiction, because you think, well, all sorts of people like general fiction. And that's where the national newspapers and magazines and TV and radio helps, because you do hit a cross-section. But if it's something niche, and if it's about an industry like writing, you know, publishing, I think the forums and all the social networks and sort of those niche areas online are definitely the way to go.
Mm. And I do think it's easier for non-fiction authors, you know, for fiction authors specifically. I mean, you've written contemporary books with themes that you've been able to, I can see, you know, how you can spin off, you know, things to talk about in interviews. What about, you know, people who write, say, fantasy? You know, how can a fantasy author or someone who's set a book, you know, somewhere else, how do they go about finding a hook for media?
I think that's where genres actually help. Sometimes I think genres don't help. So if people are trying to pigeonhole work as something that it's not, and I've struggled with genres with my work because it's fiction and it's commercial and page turner, but it's not it's certainly not literary, but it's also not chick lit, and so I struggle with pigeonholes. But in some cases, it really is genre writing. And in those cases, there are communities, mainly online, some of them offline, for people who, you know, love fantasy or sci-fi or whatever it is. And I think that's probably the best place for them, because people don't mind if it's in the right environment online. People don't mind someone saying, oh, I've got this book out and it's about this and it's a bit like this and this. But if it's not the right environment, then obviously you don't want to be salesy. But there are places, I think, for genre fiction online.
Mm, no, absolutely. So I'm also interested in, you know, sort of going back to your story. You mentioned the milk round, and some people might not know what that is. And I was at Oxford. You were at Oxford, right?
I was Cambridge.
Cambridge. Bah, boo.
Wouldn't hold that against
boo,
you.
Boo, yes. But for people who don't know, the milk round is when, you know, big companies come to universities like Oxford and Cambridge, and we go and we meet them, and then we go get a job in the city. And I did the same as you. And, you know, and I've got this thing about Britain where I think I had to be in Australia to self-publish because of the literary snobbery that exists in this country. And particularly when you come out of Oxford and Cambridge and you go to the city, that snobbery seems even worse. So I want to know, how did you break through that feeling and self-publish back then?
Yeah, you're so right about the snobbery, and it's not just literary. this country does have an issue. I do remember being told when I'd first published my book, and obviously I'd published it myself, being told by lots of people, oh, you've done very well to get a publishing deal. Oh, it's very hard to publish a book, isn't it? Very hard. And nobody thought to even look at who had published it. And if they'd looked carefully, they would have seen that it was self-published. I, at the time, didn't shout about it because the self-publishing and vanity publishing were almost synonymous. And no, it was basically that snobbery you talked about. So I didn't shout about it. I'm very happy to shout about it now, because actually people are waking up to the fact that it is a proactive choice you can make. But back then it was definitely seen as a last resort. But internally, having to come to terms with that kind of feeling that I was going against the grain, I suppose I just basically felt really strongly that there was this market for the book that I was writing. I had that conviction, and I had to just believe that the publishers had made the wrong decision, which is quite an arrogant thing to say. But I think sometimes the filters that they put on, particularly now with the market changing and the publishers losing so much power to the retailers and feeling so kind of terrified of making a mistake, I think the filters that they apply are sometimes maybe not wrong, but maybe they're just, you know, they will only want to sell a book if they can guarantee it will sell some copies, whereas I would take that risk. So it was a risk thing, but yeah, it paid off.
No, well, let's call it confidence and not arrogance, because I get that, you know, and from you, you know, you on TV as well, I think that confidence is really important, but a lot of authors feel, you know, the pressure, then they're not confident. So have you got any tips for kind of, is it fake it till you make it? Is that what you did?
I think the way I did it, it's hard to sort of look back and analyse, but I think the way I do it generally is to try and involve as many people as I can along the way on the journey, because people often say to me, oh, writing can be very isolating. And those are the same people who also think that, you know, they have no confidence if they're writing. And actually, I think it doesn't have to be isolating. I think if you get people involved, and people who want to be involved, obviously, but you'd be surprised how many friends and family and people, you know, do actually want to get involved. And I'm talking about, you know, they want to help with the editing or particularly with the promoting. They'll be involved, and that will give you confidence, because you realise that they've read the book and that they actually enjoyed it, and there is a market out there for it. And you haven't just written it for yourself, you've written it for people who are going to enjoy those words on the page. So I think people is the key, collaborating.
Mm. No, I think you're right there. And so how do you sell your books now? I mean, do you, and I mean market your books, is it, do you blend online marketing? How are you doing that now?
Yeah, it is definitely a blend now, because actually my book sales are about 50-50 paperback and ebook overall across all titles. And bizarrely, it changes quite a lot between titles. But because that's 50-50, I can tell that the kind of readership is a mixture of types, and therefore they don't all hang out on Twitter all day, but some of them do. So I do Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube and all those things online. I do things by email quite a lot. A lot of face-to-face, actually. I just sort of meet up for coffees and help spread the word in various ways. But also I do use traditional media as much as I can. And as you said, it's fortunate because the things that I love to write about tend to be a social issue or something that's mildly political or something that's generally quite topical. And that helps because that gives the hook for the media. But yeah, definitely a blend.
And do you have, I'm sorry, back on media again, because this fascinates me, and looking at what you're doing makes me think, oh, I should maybe try a bit harder, because it's also about personality branding, isn't it? Around that, it can be very good for your just name recognition.
Yeah, definitely. And people come up to me and say, oh, you're the one that dumped the publisher. Yes. And no matter what they thought of that story, they remembered it, and it helps.
It does. So is it, you know, let's just be... And maybe this is too commercial, some people will be like, ah, but when you're actually thinking about writing your book, right at the beginning, should you be thinking about these topics and things that potentially might be newsworthy?
There's two schools of thought. I do, but I don't write purely based on the PR hook. Absolutely not. I don't think I'd be able to force my writing if I didn't want to be writing about it. But I can tell that having spoken to a lot of authors, some of them just, yeah, they would curl up and cringe if they thought they had to do that before they started writing, because a lot of people do write because it starts off as a kind of cathartic process and they just want to get it out. And I think that's a really good and valuable way of writing, and you can get some really good work out of from that. So I guess they would just definitely not want to think about PR hooks, but if you can, then I would recommend doing that, because it may be even just a small strand of the plot that you might want to put in, but it might be enough to become a hook for the press later.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And but I mean, now, you know, if people do get a publishing deal, you often have to think about marketing really early on in the process, and self-publishers, I think, have to as well. So I don't think people can shy away from the word marketing. But no. Just another question on that. You're an engineer, you were in investment banking, and now you know all this stuff about, you know, media. Do you have media training, or is this something you learnt along the way?
I've actually never had any media training. I don't know what it would entail, and maybe I should have some. But, but yeah, maybe, I just, I guess, don't swear on TV. Someone once did say to me something about not wearing shiny earrings on TV. But apart from that, I'm not sure. I think a lot of it is sort of watching and observing, and that goes for newspaper and magazine writing as well, because... when I write for Grazia, it's a very different style of writing to when I write for The Guardian. Mm-hmm. And that's really just from, you know, looking at what's out there already. And I don't actually read a lot of women's magazines that I write for, so I have to read them in advance of that. So, I guess it's a bit of copycat and just common sense.
and learning along the way and confidence again.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, really, the confidence thing. I think just... don't be afraid of those journalists and producers, because they're just humans as well, and they're just doing a job, and actually you'll find that they're quite receptive to ideas. They'll often just ignore you or say, no thanks, not today. In fact, you'll get that 9 out of 10 times, but you know that 1 out of 10 is worth gold dust in a lot of cases.
And what? I'm sorry, I keep going on about this, but I'm so fascinated. Does it take a lot of time to do all of this pitching and all of that? Because I don't have a TV, so I don't watch TV. I saw you at the gym. but, you know, and I read The Guardian on my phone, but I don't read any other magazine stuff. So I'm like, God, if I was to pitch things, I'd have to go and read all this stuff and watch all this stuff.
There's a lot of stuff online. There's a lot, really. When I first went on Sky News, I was asked to do the newspaper review, and I thought, what actually does that entail? And I literally Googled it, and someone had put a clip up, and I was like, oh, right, yes, I'll do it. And that would be my other tip. Always say yes, and then work out how you're going to do it later. If you get an opportunity, take it.
But do you, like, monitor things like, you know, do you monitor any specific feeds or any subscribe to any services?
That's a good point. I am only really in a sort of... business sense, if that's the right word. I monitor what's going on kind of in the media and what's happening kind of with brands and various things that just happens to interest me. But other forms of kind of alerts and feeds, I guess, really I just stay on top of the news, and that's sort of various sources. So yeah, Guardian on the phone is invaluable, and sort of, yeah, I guess a few free newspapers and magazines, that sort of thing, just sort of picking up whatever I can. But yeah, I don't know if you necessarily need a TV to keep it. No, I don't think you do you? But as going back to the time element that you mentioned, it is time consuming. It really is. Particularly pitching to newspapers and magazines. Like I said, you'll get 9 out of 10 times you'll get a rejection, and you'll think, I spent all day, like, you know, firing off emails trying to get into a newspaper with this story. But it does pay off sometimes, so it's worth doing.
Oh no, that's a really good tip, and it's different for this podcast, and you know we don't really talk about this, so this is fantastic. But last question before I let you go, yeah, we've mentioned the Guardian a few times, and for the Americans listening, you know, the Guardian is, I think it's kind of a highbrow newspaper, you know, quality yeah, newspaper and website, and again, when we talked about snobbery, I would say the Guardian is up there, and there's been quite a bit of anti-self-publishing stuff written by a few journalists who we won't name. But you've been doing, or you are in the middle of doing, some breakfasts for the Guardian on self-publishing, and I'm kind of gobsmacked. So, do you think this shows a change in attitude? Do you think it's self-publishing is the new in thing in Britain?
I think people are quite confused about where the market's going, and the way that they still are a bit confused about the music industry, and is it going online or offline, and is it going traditional, or is it fragmenting into everyone self doing it themselves? And because there's this transition, there's whatever's going to happen, there's definitely a transition underway, that's creating kind of banter between the people who feel strongly either way. And I think that we can all use that to our advantage. If we really feel strongly that self-publishing is the way forward, then we can try and prove that. And that's, I guess, what I'm doing with the Guardian Masterclass, is just saying how you can do it successfully. Because let's face it, with everyone trying to self-publish, that means it's even harder to kind of rise above it and stick your head up. And one of the ways you can do that is to effectively replicate what the traditional publishers have done in the past, but do it better in a lot of ways. And promotion is one of those ways.
Fantastic. So where can people find you and your books online?
Amazon, and I guess my webpage and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. I guess Google me. Yeah,
and just
hopefully,
your
hopefully the right things will come up.
And just tell us your URL.
It's www.pollycourtney.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Polly. That was great.
Thanks. Nice speaking to you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!